Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mush, You Huskies. It is our eighth day of our Iditarod coverage, and on the line we have our co-host, Michelle, calling in from Denver. How are you?
You know, it's been quite a day. You know that I work on Saturday, so I started off my day at 6 o'clock this morning, and I'm not quite home yet. Just a little side note, a lot of our fans know about our dog, Kane, and he's had Happy Tail and had surgery 2 weeks ago, and last night he decided that it itched too much and decided to tear out all the sutures, so he will be heading in more surgery again on Monday morning. And sorry, Robert, that's the first you're hearing about it, but needed to let you know one way or another.
Sounds good. Well, I hope he's doing well. Also on the line is our Iditarod expert, Jason Barron, calling in from Lincoln, Montana. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing great, and as usual, I'm happy to be here. This is a lot of fun, and I tell you, I've got a lot of my personal friends. I made a lot of new connections kind of through this program, and I think people are having a lot of fun with it, so I'm just glad to be a part of it.
I think they are, too. You know, Jason and Michelle, a lot of people have commented to me back and forth about how much they're gaining from this show, and we're really putting it into focus in a little bit different format than they're reading through the newspaper articles and blogs and things. And I am so happy that we're continuing our coverage and look forward to getting into some of the nitty-gritty, as you're calling, the end game. As you wrote about this morning and talked about last night on our show as well. But before we get into that, I want to make sure that we do thank all of our listeners that are listening and telling their friends about it. We've really had a tremendous upswing in the number of listeners to our show, and I'm so happy that they are a part of it. So before we get into tonight's show, I want to make sure that we clarify a couple of things that we talked about yesterday. The first thing is, we were moving very quickly yesterday, and the reason so is so many things are happening so quickly here at this part of the race that often we're just talking a million miles an hour, and sometimes people aren't catching everything we're saying. So just kick back, listen, see what you can get out of them. If you have questions or comments, either send myself or Jason a message on Facebook or Twitter or wherever else you have questions, and we'll make sure we do our best to answer those. With that, Jason, you wanted to clarify a couple of things that you talked about last night in regards to some mushers. So let's talk about that first.
Well, and you led into that very well. I like how you led into that because, you know, like I said last night, like, you know, when it comes to parsing the numbers, this is like a big yo-yo. We're spread between, you know, several 300, you know, 300 something miles now. We've got all these checkpoints involved from one end of the race to the other. So it's all very complicated. And I consider myself a professional analyst. I mean, I am good at crunching these numbers, and I blew it hardcore. I mean, I couldn't have fumbled the ball any worse with Hans Gott and Sebastian Schnell. I completely lost track of the math that I should have been employing. And essentially what happened was I had them in my little fact sheet, my little cheat sheet, was that they were about 4+ hours behind the pace setter, which was Hugh Neff coming into Anvik. And within reality, they were probably more like 2+, like in that 230, 240 range. And I was thinking 430, 440. And I mean, I'm really good at this. I've been doing this my whole life, and I blew it hardcore. And as soon as I realized, I mean, like an hour after the show, I actually got there and went through the numbers, and I was horrified. I mean, I saw what I had said, and I saw what the reality was, and I immediately on the blog, on all my social media that I'm a part of, I mean, I just went around trying to straighten that out. And then it was a big focus of the blog this morning, the prelude to the end game. And anyway, so if I can, I guess the moral of the story would be if I can muff it. I mean, this is a devilishly difficult, race to parse the numbers. Is all there is to it. It's complicated.
It is, and you know, we talked quite a bit about that yesterday about just how difficult it is for the average fan to follow the race, especially when we're talking about 8-hour checkpoint or rest as well as 24-hour checkpoint or rest and things like that, and when people take those and who hasn't and who has and all that. Just about all the top guys have taken those rests, haven't they, Jason?
Yeah, I think the 8-hour breaks. Yes, and interestingly enough, something was being pointed out to me too. There, I kind of lost my train of thought. Interestingly enough, there is a couple players that have emerged into the top 10 who haven't taken their 8-hour break, and they haven't made it to Caltag yet. Very few drivers have actually made it to Caltag, but they're roaring upon it now. Is Jesse Royer moving really nicely, and Sven Hultman, not moving quite as well, but moving very nicely. And they've been running a really unorthodox strategy that is so – they've been back out of the top 10 under the radar, essentially. I haven't been paying attention to them, and stopping in really unorthodox areas. Like they didn't – you know, they took Straw with them and camped on the river, which is way unorthodox, just shy of Eagle Island, and they so far have not taken their 8-hour breaks. Now – you know, I think what's going to happen is they're going to come into Caltag. They're going to be that 4 or 5 hours off the pace and need to take their 8-hour breaks. But they're set up, especially in the case of Jesse, set up really well for an ultra powerful finish. I mean, this is the end game now. The race actually becomes, kind of exciting in the sense that now you actually see drivers are racing to a goal, to the finish line, whereas up until this point, you know, 600 miles is really just about jockeying for a position and trying to not lose too many dogs and just not fall too far behind, but it's really more about maintaining and hopefully not having too many problems, where now it becomes about racing, and it's really significant that Jesse is up there. I don't think she's going to be in a win scenario, but she is going to rocket into the top 10 before the show is over.
You know, I'm sitting here looking at the current standings on AnchorageDailyNews.com, and it has Jesse Royer in 9th place currently and Didi Genro in 10th. What is your opinion about having two women in the top 10 right now? How does that factor in to their strategy as well as the guys that are ahead of them, the Linders and the Schnulls and the Nuts
are
and those guys?
Well, I don't look at like as a competitor, I make no distinction between the sexes. I mean, when I'm racing with Jesse Royer, who I know very well and raced numerous times, I've known Dee Dee since I was a little boy, and like I'm fond of saying, I tower over. She's a little thing. I tower over her, but I still look up to her. I mean, incredible woman. But with that said, I out there in the trail, nobody's looking at Dee Dee like, oh, there's a woman's in the top 10, or oh, Jesse. The drivers, let me tell you, they're just afraid. You know, they just see Dee Dee and they see Jesse. They know they're there for business. They know they have great teams and they're ultra talented competitors. They're just a couple more threats have entered the board.
You know, my friend and I were talking this afternoon about your kind of dark horse favorite for the last few days, Ramey Smith, who is now in 2nd place. I'm not sure exactly. It doesn't list here how far behind John Baker he is, but you're hitting it right on the numbers in terms of Ramey. He really is putting the pedal down and making it go. What is the deal between him and Baker and Ramey right now on the trail?
I just want to go on record here too, because there's plenty of pundits and you know, one thing is when you come, and that's why I'm a shameless plug on my blog and my coverage of the races. I'm not afraid to take chances. Most journalism and even sort of some of the professional mushers who are writing about the Iditarod essentially kind of wait until the last minute to make some kind of prediction that kind of puts their credibility on the line. I started calling Ramey a dark horse back before the drivers even left Nikolai, and part of this was due to the fact that I grew up with him. I've known him since I was a kid, and I saw the signs of his stars coming into alignment, and also because my older brother Laird, who's also a pro musher, and he's been out of it for a while, but we had a big discussion about Ramey before Ramey even left Nikolai. This was back when Martin was still looked like the magic carpet ride. And we started calling, and we both agreed on this, and we had a big conference about it, and then we started calling that in all our different things we were writing about, and certainly all my blog and stuff. So I've been trying to stay on top of the Ramey thing as it's developed, and so far I've called it 100%. I would say that he's the guy to beat. I mean, Ramey's going to – I mean, right now it's going to take a UFO alien abduction or something to keep him from overwhelming Baker. He almost did it on this run.
How far back are they? What's the time? Do you know?
He made up just shy of an hour on Baker. Baker. This was a very exciting day. Baker was led into Eagle Island, just like we talked about yesterday. He was emerged as the new kind of top powerful team. Hugh was right there. Hugh stayed there kind of with him, but Baker was running a little faster. He led the way into Eagle Island, and then he cut his break short. He took just under 4 hours, and he took off to Caltech. He's been in Caltech for about an hour and a half. The real question we'll be talking about is, okay, now what? What's he going to do now that he's there? And Ramey, who took off about approximately 3 hours behind him, somewhere in that range, took the same type of break, 4 hour break, and pulled almost an hour on Baker going to Caltech. Now I'm sure Baker's the first he's hearing of this as he's getting into Caltech, that he's got this fire breathing dragon coming down his backside. And what it really means is Ramey Smith is one of those guys that he's never really been this close to the front. And that's what we were saying back in Nikolai. He's never been this close to the front with such a big, powerful team. But he's always, from whatever point he's at in the standings, he's always the one of the best, if not the best, closer in the last 400 miles of the race. So it's pretty simple math. I mean, you look at him and go, he's got 14 dogs. He's got one of the biggest teams in the race. So it's obviously he's got plenty of dog power. He's making these epic runs. I mean, with speed, he's pulling crazy amounts of time on everybody. He was with Hugh Neff and Sebastian Schnell taking off out of Eagle Island, and I think they're there now. So I don't know what their exact time is because I just saw their transponders pulling in. But he had went from being with them leaving Eagle to being 6 miles in front of them when he pulled into Caltech, which gives you an idea. I mean, he's basically overwhelmingly powerful at this point. There's no question that he can outpower John Baker. It just comes down to if John Baker wants to beat him, he's basically got to go he's either got to step aside or go kamikaze, and I don't think it's any guarantee that he can beat him even if he goes kamikaze.
Michelle, you had something to add?
Well, yeah, I'm looking here, and I'm noticing that Schnell and Smith both have 14 dogs left there, you know, for the last few hundred miles of this race. And I think that has a lot to do with their strategy. I mean, Ramey Smith, we all know, has a more powerful team because everybody out there has been saying his dogs are eating the best, his dogs are coming in as if they, you know, just went around the corner and had a little sprint jog race. They are looking the healthiest out on the trail this year, and I think that has a significant play in how everybody else is going to strategize their teams who aren't necessarily as healthy, as strong, nor are they running as many dogs. You know, when you're running, like Mackie is down to 9 dogs and Hugh's down to 12, that's a significant difference between 14 and 12. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but 2 dogs is a lot of power to be given a team.
Jason?
Well, you know, again, it comes down to, like, how many dogs are, you know, in that 14 or 12 are pulling. I mean, I don't make a lot of distinction between what the power difference is between 12 and 14, but you certainly have a few more spare tires. I mean, you know, it's really all about what kind of number of dogs you want to come into Nome with and still have some power. And, you know, obviously with 14, you got a couple more spare tires than the guy with 12. I would say that the real big difference is when you start seeing the 10-dog team and the 9 like Lance has. And, you know, I'll tell you, too, and this is a contrast from yesterday, you know, Hans is doing something really strange out there, everybody. I don't know, you know, exactly what it is. I hope it's not a problem. But what I suspect is he stopped about, I'm just guessing now, about 20 miles before the checkpoint of Caltech. He's out there taking a little break, and I can tell this from the transponders. Well, I think what's going to happen, probably when I go to look at it again after the show, we'll find that he's moving, that he took a two-and-a-half-hour break, something of that nature, and that he's going to pass up Caltech and go down the trail a ways and take a 3 or 4 hour break and then go on into Unalakleet. This is significant because I think a lot of people, sort of orthodox you know, methodology is you pull into Caltech and take a 6 hour break and then run on to Unalakleet. So in a lot of ways, what we're seeing with Hans is the fact that he was right there with Sebastian and Hugh and Ramey, moving great, moving very powerfully, and then he pulled over for this break I'm talking about. Well, maybe it's something else. I mean, maybe something happened to him, but I kind of doubt that. You know, so you see some sort of really kind of cool, sort of neat strategies that are designed to throw other people off, including the fans, off their game. And it's almost impossible to really guess what it is because it's so unusual. Sebastian is just talking about the ultimate guy of just, he's no frills, no flash, Mr. Laid Back, and he just gets the job done. I just can't tell you how much I admire watching his performance and his character growth over the last few years. I mean, he's really turned into this total consummate pro that you just don't hear a real big deal made out of him, because he's not the playmaker. He's not the guy out there making the early exciting runs, you know, and just sort of taking the headlines. But he is such a deal closer. He's moving along with this team, and my wife called this when she saw the video of them coming through McGrath. He came trotting in, and his team just looks so controlled, so professional, and so powerful that I think that's really one of the secrets to his success, is that he's there with his team that's never like overrunning itself. Like at this point, I think speed to some extent can be a liability if you start injuring up dogs and wearing them out. Whereas I don't think you have to worry about that with Sebastian. He's always just kind of on this even keel, doing exactly the same thing day after day after day. I think that, you know, I'm not trying to say that Baker isn't in a good position. He's an hour in the lead. He's in first place by an hour, but I do think that Sebastian, and I mean, I think it's a given. I mean, Ramey is going to overwhelm Baker. I mean, I'm going to put money on that. I think Sebastian's got a great shot at beating Baker too, and it's just so hard to assess what Hugh's doing. Hugh's moving along really nice, but the fact that Hugh took such a long break, he took 6.5 hours, which is nothing wrong in and of itself at Eagle Island, but it kind of indicates that he's backing off. It kind of indicates that he's, now, and I hope I'm wrong about this because he's having a spectacular race, but it kind of indicates that he's thinking that he can't keep pushing and that now he needs to back off and just try to get into Nome and not really worry about winning so much. I may be wrong. I hope I am. But that's kind of what the numbers are telling me right now. But he certainly is moving miles per hour very nicely. But right now, if I really had to kind of put the money on this, I would say, look, Baker's clearly in a good position. He's clearly powerful. Personally, I think he's going to be gone out of Caltech in about an hour and a half. I think he's going to go kamikaze, and what he's going to do is he's going to go, Ramey, if you want to beat me, you're going to have to put the hammer down and go with it. If you let me go, you'll never see me again. So then the strategy becomes, and the interesting thing for us fans is, oh, what does Ramey do? He's clearly got the stronger team, but does he cut his rest and, you know, get that eight ball going? So it's going to get pretty interesting over the next couple hours.
So my last point in terms of strategy is, a lot of talk has kind of died down about Lance Mackey. They're even saying he's in survival mode. So can you give us a little bit of update on Lance?
Well, there's not really a whole lot to update, you know, in terms of like sounding like I have – like I don't have a crystal ball. I don't want anybody listening to this program thinking I have a crystal ball. I have educated guesses from all this, you know, I have a lot of experiences racing and watching races and being around racers. So all I'm really doing is just giving you the best educated guesses that I have. And I'm unafraid of taking a chance with those opinions. That's what I was trying to say about Ramey. I mean, I'll always tell you really honestly. And I'm not going to say what I think the fans want to hear, because a lot of times what happens is I get flack because I dare to say someone is infallible, you know, isn't infallible. You know, I got to tell you is that I've known Lance my whole life. I was watching, you know, I've been out there racing with him when he rose to power before he was powerful, and I'll race with him again. And what I'm going to tell you is I think that Lance was essentially, his goose was cooked at Nikolai. I think he did a great job of rehabilitating his chances, and he fought like a madman. His family, his fans, everybody out there should be proud of Lance, that he basically did the best he could to try to stay in play for winning all the way to Eagle Island until he reached a tipping point, and now he's pulling back. I don't think he's in any danger of not finishing the race. I think he'll finish competitively. So I'm talking about these in relative terms. I think he's pulled the plugs from actually saying, I am trying to stay with the pace. Lance Mackey doesn't sit in checkpoints for 7.5 hours, 45 minutes. He sits in them for 3 or 4. He sits in them for like what Baker and Ramey were doing. So you know that if he's taking these twice as long of breaks, he's telling everybody, I'm backing off. I'm coming back now. I'll come get you next year. You know, and remember, we're talking about a guy who's probably going to win 5 more Iditarods before his career is over. So I don't feel sorry for him. It's just that these are the breaks. This is, imagine how Martin feels right now. He's not having any fun either. So, right. You know, I think Lance is in survival mode with this caveat. I don't think that he's in survival mode to the point where, you know, they're going to, you know, we're going to see Lance not finish. I just think we're, you know, I think he recognizes that he can't keep pushing like Ramey and Hugh and Sebastian and, you know, the stronger teams. His team isn't strong enough to do it. He's wisely pulling back. That's how I interpret the numbers.
So let's switch gears just a little bit, Jason. We're talking to Jason Barron, 7-time Iditarod finisher, as well as a very accomplished writer. He wrote a book called Ballad of the Northland. Check it out. You can buy it right here on the Blog Talk Radio page, as well as through his blog, Mr. MR, Jason Barron at .wordpress.com. Jason, let's talk a little bit about Mitch Seavey. I know that he was taken out of the race several days ago for an unfortunate accident where he cut his finger nearly off. But the question that is out there, at least from what I am getting, is what is the difference between a scratch and a withdrawal? It says here on the leaderboard that he was withdrawn while all of the other guys and gals say scratched.
Well, typically that's because the driver wants to – I don't have the exact definition of the rules in front of me, so this is my interpretation of the rules as opposed to what they literally say. When a driver is withdrawn – It's kind of a more diplomatic way of saying disqualified. But for all intents and purposes, that driver wanted to continue, and the officials came to that driver and said, "You are not fit to continue for whatever reason." It can be a disqualification is probably a more of a negative connotation. That's why we're going to use withdrawn, because a disqualification would be they broke some rules and they did something that was really negative, and therefore they were being punished, as opposed to, you know, by being pulled, as opposed to withdrawn by a person who is doing the best they can, and it's through no fault of their own that something happened to prevent them from continuing. In this case, they're looking at his ability to take care of his dogs, and also they don't want the poor guy. You know, they don't want the guy going out there and bleeding to death either. I mean, you know, it's like you're all humped up. You're you know, it's 20 or 30 below in an early morning, and you get this. You know, what happened was he had this knife that he had lost his main cutter, his straight. He has a, you know, like a fixed blade cutter, and he lost that, and he was relying on his backup folding knife that has a squeeze handle so that you squeeze it to release the lock on the blade and close it. And basically, what happened was he close it on his index finger and basically severed his finger almost completely off through the knuckle. So you can imagine how gory that was. I mean, that probably was just blood everywhere and just a big mess. And, you know, I've known Mitch forever. I mean, they don't make him a lot tougher than Mitch, and he probably just wanted to wrap a booty around it and get a move on down the trail, because he probably didn't realize how bad it was. So basically what probably happened is about two or three vets and, a couple officials probably, sort of gang-piled him and had an intervention. And, you know, he's sitting there on a world-class team that would probably be one of the front runners right now. It was coming together. Things were looking good. And the last thing he wants to do is be out of the race for something like that. So anyway, so that's the difference between withdrawn. The other one is voluntarily. A driver pulls in and, you know, like Judy Currier, I heard, just scratched, or she is going to scratch, because she was down on dogs. She was down to her very last leader, who had been dealing with a mild case of kennel cough, but it was the only leader she had, and it was the only dog that would make her team go. And she pulled in the Anvik, and for the last day or so, this kennel cough had been developing secondary infections and getting down into forget what the dog's name is, but her leader's lungs, and was, you know, basically really went from an irritant to compromising the dog's health. And she knew that without that dog, she could not continue. You know, her team wouldn't go. So she scratches. So that's more of a voluntary thing. That's just
so
one example.
With scratches, Jason, sometimes it happens if you're equipment malfunctions or literally explodes on the trail, like if your sled hits a tree and just shatters into 100 pieces, and there you are scratching your head. God knows how far from the next checkpoint, and you're saying, wow, how am I going to get from point A to point B? And I know you have a great story for that. We've been teasing our listeners with that for several days now. Let's hear your story about sled repair.
Well, it was back in 2002. We just started up this kennel, Conabear Enterprises, my wife and I, and we were running what is called a puppy race, and we had these young teams. You'll hear us talking about this, where we run these puppies, and we're talking about 18 to 24 month old dogs, and they can run the race, but just not at a competitive pace. They run really fast, but basically instead of making these long runs with very little rest, they make very short runs very fast, and then take lots of rest. And basically what it means is they're always very powerful. Typically a nice puppy team at the back of the pack in the standings is actually having much faster times and much more powerful runs than, say, the winner of the race. That's very common. And it was kind of a neat experience. It was my first year being with my wife to be, my kennel partner Harmony, and we each had a puppy team. And Doug Swingley was running a team non-competitively that year he had a puppy team in the race. So there was four of us: Daniel Vetch and Doug, and then myself and my wife. And we were just putzing through the Alaska range, and we were doing these runs where we'd pull into Finger Lake and take 16 hours, and then we'd do this 2.5 hour run, just blaze over to a rainy pass, and we'd sit there for 8 hours, and then we'd blaze over to literally Doug Swingley, actually, you hear these runs like 4 hours, 3 hours and 48 minutes, that type of thing. Doug actually got from Rainy Pass to, we were taking so much rest that his team actually got him over to Rainy Pass to Roan in like 2 hours and 40 minutes. I mean, it's just some absurd time. And what that really means is that you're just like having this Rondi team going to the mountains, and this is a rough trail. Well, long story short is we got in kind of late in the evening into Roan with these really overpowered teams, overrested, overpowered teams, and the trail was a very low snow year, lots of ice and dirt and rocks and stumps and very little snow, and so which is very difficult when you have such a powerful team because it's just more dangerous. And long story short is we took this long break and took off in the wee hours of the early morning, just as the sun came up out of Roan. And we were taking off, and we were going down the trail, and we got to what they call the glacier. It's about 12 miles out of the checkpoint of Roan, and it's a ravine that's probably got this really lively little creek running down it in the summertime, though I've never seen it. But it's kind of like a lava flow, but slick. It just glaciates something fierce in the wintertime, and sometimes it's not too bad, but this time it was. And it's very difficult, very steep, and very difficult to get up. And it took us about an hour and a half dealing with all these catastrophes. I have a great story that I could tell about it. I just can't get into it tonight because it's too long. But ultimately what happened was we got over this thing, all four teams over this thing. It was a big challenge. And Doug and I were in the front. Harm and Daniel were behind us. And we take off. And Doug runs off and leaves me. And I go about a mile or two past the glacier with this overpowered team, and there's this one, it was like a ski jump with a bunch of frozen tundra about 5 or 6 feet, like almost like a drop off an embankment. And I went flying over, and I wasn't paying enough attention. I landed kind of funny on one runner, and then right after that, I realized that runner felt kind of funny, and I looked down, and that just landing like that had basically broken. It was a three-stanchion sled, and there were three stanchions on each side, a real kind of stiff bomber kind of sled. Well, all three stanchions had been completely, I mean, just down to nubbins, and the runner on that side was wobbling around like a ski under me. There was almost nothing attaching this runner to the bed of my sled. So, I mean, I'm sitting there with a sled that is almost ready to come in half. And I'm like, oh, you know, so I kind of vocalize some sort of less than polite, you know, word, and I pull over. I'm like, what the heck am I going to do about this? So we all carry these little, you know, some drivers are more complex than others, but I carry a roll of duct tape and a bunch of hose clamps. And I actually got to the point where I started carrying a couple, what I think of as a splint. And there was enough of each stanchion coming off of the runner that they broke kind of high up by the bed of the sled. So it wasn't like sheared off at the runner. So here's what I did. I pulled over in an area that was lots of like little alders and lots of like little tiny spruce that were maybe, you know, as big around as a banana down to, you know, as big around as a pencil. Lots of like little brushy kind of things. So I pulled over, anchored the dogs off, fed them, got their tug lines off, just like we were going to camp again, and then, you know, got them all, like, kind of camped so I could deal with my sled. And I got back, and I cut down three of these. I stripped three of these, like, little saplings, cut them to length, and each one was a little longer than the other. Like, there's one for the back stand, just pretty long, and then, and I got these all squared away. And then I attached them from the upper part of the existing stanchion down to, all the way down to the runner, and they connected the broken part just like a splint would on a broken leg. And I wrapped them up really good with duct tape, and then I put four hose clamps on each one. That's what we have these hose clamps for. And nowadays, I actually haul cable ties for that reason too, and pre-made splints. But back in that day, you know, all I had was my axe and the actual the hose clamps and the duct tape, and then I basically taped that thing back together. And it took me, oh, it probably took me about 45 minutes. I mean, you know, I went from having a runner. And savage. I mean, there was no snow out there. I mean, it was just icy, and everything was hard. It was exactly the type of trail that would make things break off your sled under the best of, you know, even if it was completely intact. And I took these saplings, cut them down, stripped them, took out my knife, and carved them down really nicely till they sort of fit. And then I put them in there, and I put the cable ties, duct taped them down like crazy, and used a whole roll of duct tape, and got moving again. And while the runner was pretty, I mean, it was pretty. I couldn't really spend a lot of time on that runner. I had to kind of put most of my weight on the other runner and do a lot of running. It got me another 150, 180 miles until I was able to get another sled. And I'm not convinced I couldn't have made it to Nome with it. It just would have been difficult.
And that's a pretty common occurrence on the Iditarod of sleds just kind of imploding, hitting trees and all kinds of stuff. With the depending on the conditions, that could happen just about any day, any time.
Yeah, and if you're not, you know, I mean, from the time I realized that my sled was broken, and this was like, I was pretty raw, you know, I've been running dogs my whole life, but this was, we'd taken a few years off, and this was my first time running the Iditarod since 1993, so I wasn't really at the top of my game. Like, you know, I deal with it much more efficiently now. But I pulled over, and I had this sled fixed and ready to travel within 45 minutes. I mean, in the great scheme of things, that's nothing. Plenty of people start the Iditarod who would have that situation and have no idea what they would do. I mean, we completely flounder and sit there for a day waiting for someone else to come along and rescue them because they wouldn't know what to do. And, you know, I learned one of these things, I didn't learn it from Jeff King, but he put it very well. I heard this, I heard he said this, and I was really, you know, struck by it, is that you had best know how to fix every part of your, what it takes to move you down the trail, or you're done. I mean, you aren't even going to think about being competitive. I mean, you don't even go into the Iditarod unless you really think you can fix anything that needs to be fixed to continue down the trail. And certainly your sled is one of the most obvious things that we can be talking about. And you know, my advice to people.
With that, Jason, I know he has said, and millions of other people, you don't want to go out and buy a new parka, you know, on 4th Avenue in Anchorage and expect to go out there and take it on the Iditarod for it to do well. You need to be able to test all of your gear under every circumstances, whether it's a parka or a pair of socks or a new sled or whatever, right?
Oh, absolutely. You bet. I mean, these sleds and your all your equipment, you need to, don't wear them out before the Iditarod, but you definitely need to be comfortable with how everything works. You bet. No doubt.
All right, so we're about out of time, and what I would like to do tomorrow, Jason, if we could, of course, I want to talk about what the goings-on are with the races, and things are going to start developing pretty quickly as we get closer to the coast. But a lot of people are asking questions to me about the middle-of-the-pack guys and some of the guys and gals that you see every year in the Iditarod. And the question that is being asked is, why do these guys enter every year knowing that they're going to be at the back of the pack or in the middle of the pack, and what is the reasoning behind that? We would just want your philosophy behind that. We know it takes tens of thousands of dollars to run this every year, and how come people do this? Maybe it's for the adventure, maybe it's for experience, maybe it's to promote their own business. That's what we want to talk about tomorrow, as well as the news of the day. Jason, anything else you want to end with?
No, I think we got it. You know, I mean, that's a lot of material, and I think we covered the front of the race. I feel bad about not covering the middle, you know, the middle of the race and the back of the race. I really honestly do. I want everybody that's listening to this to understand that. We only have this 30, 35 minutes to give this show, and the reality is I can't make any of these points that need to be made about any part of the race without delving into them with some detail. And the simple fact of the matter is we would need about 90 minutes to properly cover the day's happenings from one end of the race to the other. So, you know, what I encourage people to do is to, you know, to get on the blogs, send me some comments, send me some messages, ask me some personal questions. And if you want me to address something and you have some real serious questions, you know, don't be afraid to, like, I don't need to do it on this radio show. I'll be happy to answer emails, personal messages on Facebook, you know, and comments on my blog. That's really what I do now instead of racing sled dogs is I run those medias, and that's how I'm, you know, kind of making a living. I would love to communicate with you and help educate you and answer any of your questions. So I encourage you, you know, anybody listening to do so.
And, you know, that's always the nature of the beast with any of those blogs or articles. You usually get about one comment for every 100 readers that are reading your material. So that's just one of those things I learned a long time ago, that unfortunately a lot of people just don't take the time to comment. And we do welcome that. We welcome that on this show and just about everywhere else that we are covering this race, on my sites and on Jason's sites and the Iditarod Trail Committee site on web, on Facebook, and everywhere else. Jason, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow. If you have anything pertinent that you want to talk about, anybody, whether it's Jason or whoever else is listening, make sure you send us a message. Take care, Jason. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much. This is Robert Forto on behalf of Michelle. Michelle, why don't you send us out? I know you've been kind of silent today.
Well, I'm just trying to keep up with everything that's going on. But I want to wish everyone out there still on the trail a wonderful, solid run all the way into Nome.
There you go. Michelle Forto on behalf of Mushu Huskies. This is Robert Forto. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow night, same time, same place, 6 o'clock Mountain Time. Goodbye.